Chapter 13, verse 3. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth followed the beast with wonder. One of the heads on this beast that we talked about last week seemed to have a mortal wound. A better translation is probably the one given in the American Standard Version, which says, "And I saw one of its heads as though it had been smitten unto death." The phrase, "as though it had been smitten unto death," does not mean that it just looked like it had been killed. It means that it was slain. It had been killed. And that's how it's portrayed here. It had been killed. You remember Revelation 5, verse 6. "I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain." That lamb was Jesus. Jesus had been slain. Jesus had died on that cross. And Jesus was portrayed there as a lamb that had been slain. Well, did this wound kill the entire beast? Or did it kill just the head on the beast? Well, later in verse 12, we're going to find out that it killed the entire beast. Verse 12 says, "Its inhabitants worshiped the first beast, whose mortal wound was healed." This was a mortal wound of the beast, not just the head on the beast. That is, the entire beast died when one of its heads died. Whatever this beast is, and we'll discuss that in just a moment, it's inextricably linked to its seven heads. As we would expect, the creature is linked to the head of the creature. And if, in fact, these heads are the emperors of Rome, as we discussed last week, then whatever this beast is something that lives and dies with these emperors of Rome. You know, we've wondered before whether the judgments in this book are pointing to, say, the city of Rome, or the nation of Rome, or to the Roman emperors. And I think this picture supports the view it's pointing mainly at those emperors, because when those emperors, the head dies, the beast dies, and then the beast comes back to life when the head is healed. Well, which emperor is depicted by the head here that is slain? Well, to help us answer that question, we once again need to turn to our angelic commentator over in chapter 17. You recall last week we spent a lot of time in chapter 17 discussing chapter 13. And that's because in chapter 17, an angel steps out of the vision and explains to John some of the things that he'd been seeing. And so we're going to look now at chapter 17, verse 8, to get a clue about who this head is here in chapter 13 that gets the mortal wound. Chapter 17, verse 8. "The beast that you saw was, and is not, and is to ascend from the bottomless pit and go to perdition. And the dwellers on earth, whose names have not been written in the book of life from the foundation of the world, will marvel to behold the beast." Why? "Because it was, and is not, and is to come." That's the mortal wound. That's the death, and then it's going to come back. The mortal wound will be healed. Well, that verse in chapter 17 tells us the first beast was, and is not, and is to come. Verse 3, we have a head on the beast that dies, but is healed. And then from verse 12, we know that that's the beast itself dying and being healed. Well, what sort of beast could have died and come back to life? What could this apply to? Well, whatever sort of beast it was, in chapter 17, verse 8, the "is not" suggests that when this vision was received, when John was writing this down, it was between the time when the beast died and the beast came back to life. Because he's using a present tense there. It is not. The time you're receiving this vision, this beast is not. It's in between those two events. Well, what then is this beast? The answer is that the beast represents Rome. Well, there's no surprise there. We already know this beast represents Rome. But it does so from a particular perspective. We've seen that so many times in this book, where God looks at something from one perspective and describes it with a vision, and then he looks at the same thing from a different perspective and gives John a different vision. And we're seeing that here. Well, what is the perspective here for this beast? This beast is showing Rome as a civil persecutor of God's people, coming from the emperors of Rome. And that persecution reached its height under Nero. Well, how do we know this? How do we know it represents the civil persecution of Rome? Well, two reasons. First, this beast that is described here and is about to be described, this is a persecuting beast. This persecution is the focus of this beast. In fact, persecution will also be the focus of the next beast in this very same chapter. But we know persecution is involved here. Second reason, we know from the description of this beast that the Roman emperors are involved here. It's described in terms of those seven heads that we spent the entire previous class talking about. This persecution involves the Roman emperors. It's coming from the Roman emperors. In fact, when one of these emperors dies, there's a lull, and then it comes back to life with another emperor, when the head comes back to life. This first beast describes that aspect of Rome. We know that all human government is ordained by God. Paul tells us that. But sometimes those human governments go bad. And in fact, this rogue Rome government is what is being shown here by this first beast. In a moment, we'll meet a second beast. The second beast will also be a persecutor of God's people. In fact, the second beast will kill those who refuse to worship the first beast. We know there's a lot of overlap between these two beasts, and we'll talk about that when we get to the second one. But they each show Rome from a different angle, a different angle. If our view of the first beast is correct, then the death of that first beast meant at that point there was a drop in persecution when the first beast died, perhaps a dramatic drop in persecution. But then when that beast came back to life, we would expect to see a reappearance of that persecution. Did that happen? Yes, that happened. We've talked about Nero. We've talked about Domitian. Tertullian said Nero was the first emperor who dyed his sword in Christian blood. Eusebius wrote that Domitian finally showed himself to be the successor of Nero, of his campaign of hostility toward God. He writes that Domitian was the second to promote persecution against us. The image of the beast coming back to life has a very interesting historical parallel. After the death of Nero in AD 68, there were many rumors that in fact he had not died, but that he was going to come back and retake the city of Rome. That belief came to be called Nero Redivivus, that he would come back to life. It became a legend, in fact. The earliest written record we have of that is from the Sibylline Oracles, and it says that Nero did not really die, but he fled to Parthia. And that he would rebuild there a large army and he would come storming back into Rome to retake the city. That was the rumor of the time. At least three Nero imposters led rebellions at this time. The first actually sang and played the lyre like Nero. And he came around during the reign of Vitellius. Then we had one that showed up during the reign of Titus. And one that showed up during the reign of Domitian. And in fact, Domitian himself was rumored to be Nero Redivivus. In other words, that is, Domitian himself was rumored to be the resurrected Nero, come back to life. Well, why would Nero Redivivus have been so frightening? What was it about Nero that would cause that to be such a frightening image? What sort of persecution occurred under Nero? What sort of person was Nero? Well, we can turn to the history books for that answer. And what we find in the history books is that Nero was a pervert, he was a murderer, he was an arsonist, he was a horrible persecutor of God's people, and the list goes on and on. Here's what Suetonius tells us about Nero. He says Nero castrated a boy named Sporus and actually tried to make a woman of him. He married him with all the usual ceremonies, including a dowry and a bridal veil, took him to his home, attended by a great throng, and treated him as his wife. And Suetonius continues, "And the witty jest that someone made is still current, that it would have been well for the world if Nero's father had had that kind of wife." We're also told that Nero married his stepsister, and that he murdered or had murdered his stepfather, his mother, and his wife. When he first tried to kill his mother, he did so by putting her aboard a specially built boat that he had constructed to collapse once it got out in the water. And it did collapse, but she swam to shore and survived. So he then had his soldiers go and hack her to pieces. And then he was a little worried about how Rome would receive him when he came back having just murdered his mother. And it might tell you something about his mother, that when he came back to Rome, he was cheered by the Romans for having killed his mother, Agrippina. Tells you something about the family of Nero. He took the wife of his closest friend, Otho, who you'll note later became an emperor for a short period of time. He took Otho's wife as his mistress and then kicked her to death when she became pregnant. In AD 64, widely thought that he set fire to the city of Rome so that he could have the glory of rebuilding it. And when suspicion turned on him, he blamed the Christians for that. And that led to persecution, widespread persecution. Everyone knew the Christians were expecting a fiery end of the world, right? So he blamed them for starting that fire. As one modern historian puts it, the belief that the fire had been started deliberately became so prevalent that Nero was forced to point a finger away from himself. He singled out the strange Eastern cultists called Christians. Tacitus described Nero's persecution of Christians at this point. He writes, "Mockery of every sort was added to their deaths. Covered with the skins of beasts, they were torn by dogs and perished, or were nailed to crosses, or were doomed to the flames and burnt to serve as nightly illumination when daylight had expired." In short, it would be harder to find or even imagine a worse enemy of God and God's people than Nero. And the rumor was that he was about to return. What happened when Nero died? Chaos and civil war followed the death of Nero. Nero did not die alone. His dynasty died with him. Why? When Nero started in power, there were six other men who could claim lineage back through the Julio-Claudian dynasty and could have taken over after Nero. By the time Nero died, he had murdered all six of them. There was not a single person left who had any claim to the Julio-Claudian bloodline. His dynasty died with him. And after he died, Galbo came to power and was quickly removed. Otho came to power and was quickly removed. Vitellius came to power and was quickly removed. Vespasian came in, and when Vespasian was made emperor, he was the fourth emperor of Rome in a 12-month period. That's the kind of chaos and civil war that followed the death of Nero. And at that time, there was a rumor that he was coming back. So what are we saying then? This beast is Rome as a civil persecuting power coming through the emperors. The beast came to the forefront under Nero after that fire. But when Nero died, so did the beast as the persecution temporarily subsided. They didn't have time to persecute anybody at that time. There was such chaos going on. When Revelation was written, the beast was still dead because Vespasian was not a big persecutor of God's people. And this book was written during the reign of Vespasian. It was written during that lull of persecution. It was written when John could write that the beast is not, present tense, it is not at the moment a persecuting power. Later, though, it came back to life. It was revived under Domitian, who Tertullian called a limb of the bloody Nero. Domitian represented a new beginning of that persecution. And that's why we discussed last week, he is denoted in Revelation as number 8. Number 8 means a new beginning, and he's restarted that horrible persecution. Verse 4. "Men worshiped the dragon, for he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshiped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast? Who can fight against it?'" In this verse, we see two of the most horrible images in this entire book of Revelation. Dragon worship and beast worship together in one verse. Ralph Waldo Emerson said, a person will worship something, have no doubt about that. We may think our tribute is paid in secret in the dark recesses of our hearts, but it will out. That which dominates our imaginations and our thoughts will determine our lives and our character. Therefore, it behooves us to be careful what we worship, for what we are worshiping, we are becoming. If we worship the dragon, then like the dragon, we will become. If we worship the beast, then we will become like that beast. And have no doubt about it, dragon worship and beast worship are alive and well today. We've already discussed this dragon. This dragon is Satan, who is the driving power behind Rome and Rome's attack on the church. He had given his authority to Rome so that Rome could attack the church in his name. And why did they worship the beast? Because it had died and come back to life. It was unstoppable. What we see here is a ghastly parody of Jesus, who truly died and came back to life. Like Pharaoh's magicians, Rome is saying, "Look, we can do that too. You proclaim a Savior who died and came back to life. We can do that too, is what they're shouting here. In fact, that's a theme that runs throughout this book. We've been looking at themes in the book of Revelation. And one of the themes, it's just right below the surface, is that for every heavenly thing, there is an earthly counterpart that is a grim parody, that is such in stark contrast. Barclay describes the question here, who is like the beast, as a grim parody of that great question in Exodus 15:11, who is like thee, O Lord, among the gods? Just imagine the scene here from the church's viewpoint. It must have almost seemed to them that even God was powerless to stop this beast. What hope did the church have against such a powerful, unstoppable beast? Would it ever be killed once and for all? Would it always come back from the dead? The situation looked very bleak. But the very next verse, verse 5, is going to provide hope to an alert reader. And if you don't see why verse 5 provides hope, then it's time for a review. Print out those notes from the website and let's have a review, because verse 5 has hope in there. Verse 5. We'll continue reading through verse 10. And the beast was given a mouth, uttering haughty and blasphemous words, and it was allowed to exercise authority for 42 months. It opened its mouth to utter blasphemies against God, blaspheming His name and His dwelling, that is, those who dwell in heaven. Also, it was allowed to make war on the saints and to conquer them. And authority was given it over every tribe and people and tongue and nation. All who dwell on earth will worship it, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain. If anyone has an ear, let him hear. If anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone slays with the sword must he be slain. Here is a call for the endurance and faith of the saints. Verse 5 tells us that this resurrected beast had authority for 42 months. Now we know what that symbol means. This statement provides reason to rejoice. A period of 42 months, that's 3.5 years. A broken seventh. We've discussed that so many times already in our study of this book. It tells us this situation is temporary. This beast has come back to life, but it's not permanent. It's temporary. The beast might seem invincible, but God is telling us here in verse 5 that all is not as it seems here. Another big theme in the book of Revelation. Jesus died and rose from the dead, never to die again. That will not be true of this beast from the sea. Jesus is a seven. This beast is a broken seven. Keep that in mind as we inch ever closer to verse 18, where we're going to see a 666. The resurrected beast is pictured here as haughty and blasphemous. Domitian fits the bill on both counts. We've already talked about that. You'll recall he required that he be addressed as our Lord God, Domitian. Remember that coin I showed you that showed Domitian's infant son who died in infancy? That coin showed him sitting on a globe as a world conqueror, reaching out towards seven stars, haughty, blasphemous. You bet, that's Domitian. The resurrected beast makes war on the church. In fact, it's actually pictured as conquering the church. This is exactly what we saw in chapter 7, verse 7, where the beast, Rome, came out of that bottomless pit and killed the two witnesses, which represented the church. Here, as in chapter 7, we're simply being shown the perspective from the beast. The beast thought he had killed the church. I'm sure the beast thought, well, I've stamped out that problem. Church won't be a problem anymore. The beast thought he had conquered. How could this beast not conquer the church? The beast was a mighty Roman Empire. How could it possibly fail to conquer this church? But things are not always what they seem. What is meant in verse 8 by the phrase, everyone whose name has not been written before the foundation of the world in the book of life of the Lamb that was slain? Well, we read a parallel statement a moment ago from chapter 17, verse 8. Does this mean that those in the book of life were predestined for salvation before they were even born? And that those not in that book were predestined to damnation before they were even born? How could it mean that? How could it possibly mean that? Sometimes I think we dignify such ridiculous notions as that by responding to them as if they had some merit. How could it possibly mean that? The entire Bible screams out against such a heinous concept. It is not God's will that anyone should perish. 2 Peter 3, verse 9. Not His will that anyone should perish. It would seem to be very difficult to reconcile that statement with the idea that God had predestined the bulk of mankind to damnation before they were born. It could not possibly mean that. A Christian should be repulsed by the idea that it means that. Why proclaim the gospel if the book of life is full? If it's already been filled up? And what about Revelation 3 verse 5, which talks about God blotting names out of that book? Well, so what is meant by verse 8? Paul tells us exactly what it means in Ephesians chapter 1 verses 4 through 6. According as He hath chosen us in Him before the foundation of the world, that we should be holy and without blame before Him in love, having predestined us unto the adoption of children by Jesus Christ to Himself according to the good pleasure of His will, to the praise of the glory of His grace wherein He hath made us accepted in the Beloved. God's plan was that there would be a book of life. God's plan was that those in His eternal kingdom would have their names recorded in that book of life. And that was God's plan before the foundation of this world. We earlier discussed what it meant for God to mark His people as His own special possession. And that mark is tied to having one's name marked or recorded in this wonderful book of life. The Old Testament closes with a beautiful description of that concept in Malachi chapter 3, verses 16 and 17. Then they that feared the Lord spake often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it. And a book of remembrance was written before Him for them that feared the Lord and that thought upon His name. And they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts, in that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spareth his own son. One of the greatest Bible scholars I ever knew was Marion Williams. I know some of you knew her. Probably most of you did not. And here's what she wrote next to Malachi chapter 3 in the margin of her Bible, which I now own. She wrote, "No matter how lonely this life, how far from loved ones and friends, think on this splendid, magnificent truth. Almighty God says of us, this one is mine." The ultimate recognition, the ultimate friendship. Yes, God has a book of life. Yes, God has a book of remembrance. And yes, that's the book you want to be in. God's book of life. What's meant by verse 10? Which says, if anyone is to be taken captive, to captivity he goes. If anyone slays with the sword, with the sword must he be slain. What is meant by verse 10? That verse is actually made up of two quotes. One from Jeremiah and one from Jesus. In Jeremiah 15 verse 2, the prophet was told to tell the people, those destined for death would go to death, those for the sword to sword, those for famine to famine, those for captivity to captivity. In other words, there's no escape from the decree of God. But verse 10, I think, also quotes Jesus in Matthew 26, 52, that all who take up the sword will perish by the sword. There are at least three lessons in that verse. First, Christians must accept the consequences that occur in this life from being a follower of Jesus Christ. And there will be consequences. We're told we will face persecution. We are told to take up our cross and follow Him. And when we take up that cross, there will be consequences. We should accept them with joy. Second, Christianity can never be defended with physical force. Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 10:4, our weapons are not carnal weapons. Third, verse 10 ends by listing what our weapons are. What are our weapons? Verse 10 tells us what our weapons are. Steadfastness and loyalty are our weapons. The Greek word translated steadfastness or endurance, it doesn't mean a passive endurance. Just whatever happens, happens. Que sera, sera. That's not what it means. It means courageously accepting the worst in this life so we can turn it into glory for God. The Greek word translated loyalty or faith means an unwavering loyalty, an unwavering faith. Those were the weapons that Christians had in the first century against the mighty Roman Empire. And they are our weapons today. Those are our weapons. And we can still conquer strongholds with those weapons. 2 Corinthians 10, verses 3 through 6. Our weapons are not carnal, but we have powerful weapons, much more powerful weapons than carnal weapons. Was the church at war with Rome? Yes. Are we at war today with the godlessness that threatens to engulf us? Yes. Are our weapons carnal? No. Our weapons are steadfast endurance. Our weapons are loyalty to Jesus Christ. Nothing on earth can defeat us while we are wielding those weapons. Verse 11. Then I saw another beast which rose out of the earth. It had two horns like a lamb and it spoke like a dragon. It exercises all the authority of the first beast in its presence and makes the earth and its inhabitants worship the first beast whose mortal wound was healed. The first beast arose from the sea. Here in verse 11, we meet a second beast that arises from the earth. Why are there two beasts? Well, one reason, as we're about to see, is God uses each to give us a different perspective of Rome, and God wanted to show us two perspectives of Rome. But is there perhaps a symbolic reason why we have two beasts? Perhaps. Earlier we saw the church shown as two witnesses. And when we looked at the seven heads, we saw that there were, and followed by an eighth head, we saw there were two that stood out. The one that died and then the eighth that came along afterwards. I think the use of two beasts here is intended to focus our attention on the two witnesses and the two great persecutors of the church, Nero and Domitian. And I think it may also be focusing us on the two dynasties that came along with Nero and Domitian. I don't think it's a coincidence that Nero ended his dynasty and Domitian also ended his dynasty. Those dynasties died with Nero and Domitian. And I think it's also pointing us to that. The first beast depicted Rome as a persecuting power from a civil side, emperors. What does this second beast depict? Well, as we always do, let's look at the clues. Let's look at the clues. The first thing we see about the beast is that it arises from the earth. This part of the beast description stresses its human origin. In verse 18, we're going to find out it's given a human number. This second beast is man-made. It's a beast made with human hands. If you ever want to have a really interesting Bible study, go back and trace through the Bible from beginning to the end the concept of things not made with human hands. In Daniel chapter 2, verse 45, we find that that great stone that toppled the kingdoms of the earth, that great stone representing the eternal kingdom of God, was not made or cut out with human hands. Also recall Acts 17, 24 through 25. God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that He is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands. 2 Corinthians 5, 1. A house not made with hands. Colossians 2, 11. Circumcision made without hands. Galatians 1, 11. The gospel that Paul preached, not after man, not a man-made gospel. There is a sharp line drawn in the Bible between those things made by man and those things not. And here we see that sharp line. Whatever this beast is on the wrong side of that line. We see some other clues about this second beast in later chapters. In chapter 16 and chapter 19, this second beast will be called the false prophet. That clue tells us this beast is religious in nature. When combined with that first clue, it seems like what we're looking at here is a man-made religion, a false religion. Verse 12 gives us another clue. The second beast causes men to worship the first beast. First beast was focused on the Roman Empire, emperors rather. So the second beast causes men to worship the Roman emperors. Finally, verse 11 tells us the second beast looks like a lamb, but speaks like a dragon. It's a wolf in sheep's clothing. Where have we seen that before? Matthew 7:15, beware of false prophets, Jesus said. Why? Because they come to you as a wolf in sheep's clothing. Again, I think we see the parity of this beast as it tries to portray itself as Christ, the true lamb that was slain. Here we see this beast also looking like a lamb, but but it speaks like a dragon. And in fact, that verse might be translated, it speaks like a serpent. And if so, it would be taking us right back to Genesis 3, where this battle started. So having considered the clues, what does this second beast depict? It depicts Rome, we know that, but from a different perspective. It depicts Rome from its perverted religious side. The perverted religious side of the Roman Empire. Not the civil persecuting side, but the perverted false religious side. Emperor worship. These two aspects of Rome were just two sides of the same coin. They worked hand in hand to stir persecution up against the church. History tells us that, and we see that here in Revelation. Verse 13. It works great signs, even making fire come down from heaven to earth in the sight of men. And by the signs which it is allowed to work in the presence of the beast, it deceives those who dwell on the earth, bidding them make an image for the beast, which was wounded by the sword and yet lived. And it was allowed to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast should even speak, and to cause those who would not worship the image of the beast to be slain. Throughout this book, that which is genuine and from God has been accompanied by that which is false and from the earth, to show us the contrast. And the signs and wonders from God are no exception. Here we see the beast also has signs and wonders. But of course, they are false signs and false wonders. Paul described them in 2 Thessalonians 2 verse 9 when he was describing the man of sin. Talked about all power and signs and lying wonders, Paul wrote. Verse 14 here confirms they're false. Verse 14 in this chapter says they deceived those who dwell on the earth. They were deceptive. They were false. Stephen Binko has written a book called Pagan Rome and the Early Christians. And he tells us that certain elements in the official Roman religion were based on magic. And that magic was an accepted form of religious piety in Roman religion. History tells us that Roman priests were both ventriloquists and magicians. And we see ventriloquism in the language here in Revelation. Originally, ventriloquism was a religious practice. And in fact, we're told that the Roman priests would make it appear as if the statues of the emperors were speaking to the people using ventriloquism, lying wonders and signs. I think we see that here. In Acts 13, I think we meet such a sorcerer who, you recall, had the Roman proconsul under his thumb. And what did Paul say to him in Acts 13, verse 10? O full of all subtlety and all mischief, thou child of the devil, thou enemy of righteousness, wilt thou not cease to pervert the right ways of the Lord? That's what we're seeing here, that kind of magic and sorcery being used in the Roman Empire. Verse 15 says this second beast would kill those who refused to worship the first beast. Well, the magistrate, the Roman religious hierarchy, they had the power of death over those who refused to confess that Caesar is Lord. This put Christians in a position where they either had to confess Caesar is Lord or confess Christ is Lord. It gave them a choice between immediate death or a few added years and then eternal death. That was their choice. You know, we rightly include confession as a step in God's plan of salvation, and we rightly confess Jesus Christ as the Son of God before our baptism, but I sometimes wonder if we really appreciate the importance of that step. And perhaps we should be thinking back on those times when that great confession was made by people who had a knife at their throat. Verse 16. Also, it causes all, both small and great, both rich and poor, both free and slave, to be marked on the right hand or the forehead, so that no one can buy or sell unless he has the mark. That is the name of the beast or the number of its name. This calls for wisdom. Let him who has understanding reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666. Verse 16 tells us the beast marked his own people. Just as God marked his people in chapter 7 to indicate that they were his, the beast marks his own people in chapter 13 for the same reason. God knows his people. Satan knows his people. Everyone on earth then and everyone on earth today is wearing one mark or the other. Each of us belongs to someone. Verse 17 tells us that no one could buy or sell without this mark, which is the name of the beast or the number of its name. We've already discussed way back when we were discussing the letter to the seven churches. the horrible economic persecution that they faced by refusing to confess Caesar as Lord. They were thrown out of the guild. They couldn't work their livelihood. All they had to do was pinch that incense and confess Caesar as Lord. Then they could make their... You can almost hear the rationalization they could have used, but they did not. They stood firm and faithful, and they refused to do that. And they suffered horrible economic persecution because of that. They were perceived as unpatriotic to Rome. They suffered horrible persecution, economic persecution, and otherwise because of that. Verse 18, one of the most famous verses in the Bible, ranking right up there with John 3:16. Verse 18 has entered the public consciousness to a greater degree than certainly any other verse in this book, Book of Revelation. People who can't even name the four Gospels can still tell you more than you care to hear, at least from them anyway, about 666. I get all kinds of questions on our website about 666. And there is so much craziness. Look at this verse. It says it calls for wisdom. And there is so much craziness about 666. Did you know that the modern barcode you find on the back of every book you buy today is the mark of the beast and an indication we're living in the end time? Some say so. Look at the barcode on your handout. You'll notice that the number six, has two little bars that represent a six. And then look at the beginning, the middle, and the end of that barcode. What do you see? Two bars. Right? There it is. Two bars. 666. It's embedded in every single barcode. Terry Cook has written a book called The Mark of the New World Order. He writes, "The entire UPC barcode system is very deceptively designed around the infamous numerical configuration biblically known as 666, the mark of the Antichrist." Mary Stuart Relfe, in her book, The New Money System 666, writes that the prophet John identified the cashless system of commerce 1900 years ago, one of which business would be transacted with a mark. The mark is the barcode, she tells us. Ridiculous? Yes, extremely so. But not uncommon when it comes to 666. So it does call for wisdom. Verse 18 tells us the number of the beast is 666, a human number. What does that mean? The number 7, we know what the number 7, this book is built around the number 7. Built around the number 7, meaning perfection. By contrast, the number 6, it's fallen short to perfection. It may have tried to be a 7, but it didn't quite make it to 7. It's just a 6. It's imperfect. It denotes something that has fallen hopelessly short of 7. It had aspirations to be a 7. It didn't make it. And what about 3? Number of divinity. Number 777. Divine perfection. 666. Something that has fallen hopelessly short of divine perfection. Does that symbol accurately describe this beast? Tell me a symbol that describes it better than that. Tell me a symbol that describes it better than that. This beast represents the false, perverted side of Rome. It represents the man-made Roman religion that worshiped the creature rather than the creator. God is 777. Rome is 666. It's a beautiful symbol showing the stark contrast between God and the perverted Roman man-made religion. Nothing man-made can ever be a 777. There are many so-called church buildings around today that should have 666 out on their sign because they're nothing but a man-made religion. God's church is a 777. But can that really be all there is to 666? Surely it must be something more than that, right? After all, it's entered the public consciousness. It's in the movies. Hollywood even knows about this one. Let's keep the 666 in perspective here. The 666 symbol is just another symbol in a book full of symbols. It may stand apart from the other symbols in the modern mind, but it doesn't really stand apart from them in this text. It's another beautiful symbol in this text. It's a wonderfully descriptive symbol. But there are many other wonderfully descriptive symbols in the book of Revelation. We need to keep in mind the purpose of this book was to provide comfort and assurance to those early Christians being set alight in Nero's garden. And if our understanding of this verse ignores them and ignores their suffering, then we've taken a wrong turn. our interpretation of this book must make sense to the first century reader. The church needed to know that Rome was just a 666, and that's what God tells them. And there are many in our world, as I mentioned, man-made religions, man-made philosophies, man-made churches, all of them just a 666. Nothing man-made can ever be a 77. On that last great day, we need to have our hope on a 777. If we're relying on a 666 on that last great day, we're in trouble. Acts 4:12, neither is there salvation in any other, for there is none other name under heaven given among men whereby we must be saved. That name is 777. Now there is another possible significance for 666 that we should discuss, and it's something called gematria, which refers to the representation of words by their numerical equivalents. And there are examples of it. If you go to Pompeii, you'll see graffiti that says, I love her whose number is 545. Somehow he was representing the name of his girlfriend by 545. The problem is you have to be so careful before you head off in this direction, because it's a sheer, steep slope leading down into nonsense. Suddenly you find people trying to find numerical significance in every word of the Bible and trying to read out secret codes from the Bible. You know, there is a message in the Scripture, but it's not hidden in secret codes. It's there for all to understand and all to heed. And those looking for these secret messages, I think they just need to start understanding and heeding the message that's there for all to understand. But, with that said, there may very well be an invitation in verse 17 for us to go down this road a little distance, because it says there the number of its name. Well, depending upon which language you use, and how you then do numerical equivalence, you can actually get Nero out of 666 in Hebrew and Greek and Latin, and there's a lot of different ways to do this. I think there is a possible secondary meaning here that 666 could represent Nero, or Domitian, who we know was Nero Redivivus. The problem is it's so hard to know for sure, because it's hard for us to know if we're doing the right mixing and matching. If you ignore the context, you can prove anything with these numbers. Take Hitler, for example. The English word Hitler, the English name Hitler, H-I-T-L-E-R. And start with A being 100, B being 101, C being 102, etc., throughout the alphabet. And then add up the letters, H-I-T-L-E-R. What do you think you get? 666. And there are so many other examples. I mean, if you're willing to toss the context out and use English and use some kind of equivalence where you start off with some number like 100, you can prove anything with numbers. That's why you have to be so careful. People have gone crazy looking for secret codes in the Bible. But I think there could be an argument made, nevertheless, that this 666 could represent Nero. And since we've run out of time, we'll pick up there next week. Thank you very much for your attention.